K-Boot Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd at the Milagro Theater in Portland. La Segua is a Central American cautionary folktale of a young, beautiful woman whom philandering men encounter on their way back home. Her beauty decays into a horror that drives the men mad. The play tells the story of a beautiful woman who was haunted by the specter of La Segua and takes a hard look at Costa Rican values, including ambition, hypocrisy, and follows themes of machismo, vanity, and narcissism. Again, that's La Segua, running February 7th to March 2nd on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday nights at 7:30 and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the NAACP kickoff to Black History Month on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library in Vancouver, Washington. The NAACP kickoff to Black History Month features performances from African drummers, actors and storytellers, artist talks, a presentation by the Buffalo Soldiers of Fort Vancouver, and much more. Again, that's the NAACP kickoff to Black History on Saturday, January 26th at 1 p.m. at the Fort Vancouver Library, 901 C Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 11:01 a.m., and we got Pacific Underground coming up next, where Jake and Sarah join Korean-Canadian poet Emily Jungmin Yoon to talk about her debut full-length poetry collection. Yes. How is this possible? Well, it's with the support of your community. That's what supports community radio. One member of your community, I'm going to tell you about a member of our community that got involved in the way and at the level that makes sense for them. Here we go. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. And now, as promised, this is Pacific Underground.
Good morning. You're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO Radio at 90.7 on the FM dial or KBOO.fm on the internets. I'm Jake Vermas, and I'm excited to introduce this interview that producer Sarah and I recorded last week with Chicago-based Korean-American poet Emily Jungmin Yoon. Her first poetry collection, A Cruelty Special to Our Species, blew us both away with its fearless reclaiming of our complicated histories from the erasure that occurs when we don't face up to our past. As a sort of content warning, I will say that many of the particular histories she is wrestling with include the violence against Korean comfort women during World War II, as well as the male violence that occurs against women up to the contemporary times. And while the treatment is very nuanced and avoids exploiting that trauma for shock value, it's still pretty difficult content. So first I will say a little bit about Emily's background. She completed an MFA at New York University and is currently a PhD student at University of Chicago. And Cruelty Special to Our Species is her first collection. So let's skip ahead to the part in the discussion where we talk with Emily about the way that some art is denigrated as political poetry or less than.
I absolutely don't think that's true, especially nowadays. I am also of the camp that everything is political, right? Even poems about trees or anything that doesn't seem to have an overt ideological conviction. So I try to read everything, every poem with that in mind, that this poet wrote it with some kind of political consciousness, and maybe it's my job to understand what it is, even if it's not right on the surface. And yeah, and if that, you know, if that, if the political belief in it is that they don't want to, for example, really say anything about politics or society, that is again a political decision that they made, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so I try to read everything with that in mind, that it was written with some, with that kind of awareness. And yeah, I suppose it's difficult though, because I also like poems that don't really say anything about, you know, the real world. I like poems that are very fantastical, or poems that are really leading into tenderness about about, you know, private love and just personal experiences. I think those are very necessary too.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I think there's this sense that it can only be one or the other, and I mean, I think people can contain multitudes, and there's so much that poems can contain. If, I mean, to bring it back to your book, there was a lot of poems that didn't really engage directly with the same political things, but were very tender, and yeah, and we'll get to that in a bit. But it was very much a, for me, it was very much a counter-argument to that kind of flattening, dismissive attitude. So, thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm glad that you said that the poems, a lot of the poems in the book seem to be about tenderness rather than about, you know, like the history that it, that the book is centered on. Because I do think that where I want my next project to be, I don't really know what my next book is going to be, because I haven't written it yet. But I think that at the end of this book, A Cruelty Special to Our Species, I was becoming more interior in my writing. I was writing about my personal experiences a lot more. Of course, connecting it to societal issues.
Right.
But I wanted to look at them with tenderness. If previously I looked at this history and this everything traumatic that happened in my own life with anger, I was turning to tenderness for some reason. I don't really know how that happened, because, you know, the more I read about the comfort women issue and the modern Korean history, I get angry.
Right.
And I think that's, yeah.
That's,
I feel like that's a natural response, but at some point for you to be able to shift towards tenderness, I think is really incredible.
Yeah, maybe it's a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
On some level, it's kind of freeing to be able to let go a little bit of that anger, but you have to go through it first.
Yeah, I think that anger is definitely necessary at the beginning, or a natural response, but at a certain point, at least, feels like it becomes unsustainable.
Yeah, I think maybe I wanted to be softer to myself. That things that happened in my life, or things that make me angry, there are other ways to think productively about them. Like you said, Sarah, anger is really necessary, and I intend to remain angry. How is it? What are the other ways that they're going to manifest in my poem specifically is something I'm thinking about a lot these days. Yeah, and before I think tenderness and just lovely poems, soft poems, like when I was in college or something, I maybe looked at them with disdain, or maybe just everyone around me who read poems looked at them with disdain. But, you know, the sentimental poems or very sweet poems, they weren't treated as if they had as much rigor. But, you know, they're so difficult to write. Yeah. I want to write more tender poems. I want to write more love poems. And mm-hmm. I hadn't written a lot before. So that's something new I'm trying. And hopefully it will come into my next book. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe it'll be another angry, sad book.
Some of the stuff that you were saying about it being a responsibility to share our stories, we noticed some of that in the author's note, particularly, you know, about what poetry is. And so we were wondering if you could maybe read part of the author's note or all of it if you feel comfortable.
Oh, sure. Okay. As poems on the comfort women of the Japanese Empire are in the heart of this collection, I'd like to mention my position in writing their stories. In 1991, the year of my birth, Kimaksun became the first former comfort woman to offer public testimony of her life as a sex slave. As more and more former comfort women of the Japanese Empire began to share their testimonies, it was clear they were speaking from within, not for the community. They put their voices together for reparations and recognition of their and the empire's history. I'd like my poetry to serve to amplify and speak these women's stories, not speak for them. I'd like my poetry to remind readers that even if a part of history may not seem to be relevant to their lives, it is. It is their reality, too. An experience that is not mine is still part of the society and world that I occupy. It is crucial to know, listen, tell, and retell various stories so we may better theorize and understand our existence.
Thank you.
Thank you for your attention on the author's note.
Yeah, it felt like to us that just set up the rest of the book and really gave at least me like a really great context for what was going to come. I really liked the part where you said poetry is not just relief, poetry is tension, poetry is departure, poetry is return memory as well. I think that was in the next paragraph after that. But just like the intentionality in those words that you chose.
Right. Because, you know, when I wrote these poems about the comfort women, of course there was an impulse to educate people on it, and a lot of people did come to me and say, I didn't know anything about this history or these women, and I learned from reading these poems, and I'm really grateful for that. And I hope that, you know, this isn't just the end, that they actually go and look up more facts and even become involved or make a donation to comfort women support organizations. And I think of my poems as not like a solution to my frustration, right? That a lot of people didn't know this history, but rather I hope that they're opening, that it's the beginning of something else. So yeah.
And what stood out for me in reading the note, especially, you know, trying to write about sort of trauma that's not yours directly, or trying to about sort of write about things internally of your community for potentially an audience outside of your community, and not wanting that to like exploit that pain or, you know, that grief in a way. The line that really stood out was that I'd like my poetry to amplify and speak for these women's stories, not speak for the women's stories, not speak for them.
Yeah. I really like what Hanif Abdurraqib said in They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us, I think. Let me see. I have to find that book. But he wrote, I think it was referring to Kendrick Lamar. Sorry, I read this a long time ago. But he was referring to a musician. And in describing this person, Hanif said, he makes music facing like his people, the specific audience, with a door open so everyone else can come in.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, and I thought that was, oh, you know what, it was about Chance the Rapper.
Okay, still.
Sorry, I like know anything about music and people and the music industry. Anyway, I thought that was such a beautiful way of describing.
Right. So you're not, your audience is not those other people necessarily, but they're still allowed in.
Yeah, it's like you're facing the people, but like your people, but at the same time, you know, it's hospitable to other people who want to enter the space and learn.
Right.
Oh, I really like that.
Yeah.
Hanif Abdurraqib.
Okay, I'll look that up. I've only read some of his essays, but
he's brilliant.
If that's one of his poetry book, I'll have to get a copy.
Yeah.
So one of the poems, or sort of, that stood out for us was the Ordinary Misfortune.
Yeah, the series of poems throughout the book.
Yeah.
And I loved how, like, that title just kept popping up as sort of like a reoccurring thing, because it's not almost in opposition to the, you know, the ordinariness of it, is that, like, it's normalized.
Yeah. When I first started writing that series, I didn't know it was going to be a series. Just like how I didn't know about so many things about this, but I didn't know it was going to have so many poems about, you know, comfort women and modern Korean history. But yeah, the title of that series, Ordinary Misfortune, came from a book, a history book about comfort women. Yeah. And, well, it said that becoming a comfort woman was so often that it became an ordinary misfortune.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is very striking. Very understated.
Yeah.
I wrote a poem, just one poem, with that as a title, and then it just kind of grew from there, thinking about what other ordinary misfortunes are there. Even in our contemporary lives.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There was that one poem, I think a little bit later in the book, that didn't only discuss a trauma of comfort women, but it seemed like it was a more modern day assault by men. I think it was the poem about putting out.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And that one stood out to me because it seemed a lot more contemporary, as you were saying. But it was still sort of along those same themes of, you know, these things that happen so often.
Right. The one that starts with, "She offers him head."
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Poem I wrote, it was just calling memories from my own experience and, you know, the experiences of young women around me. And it was a difficult poem to write, for sure. You know, because I feel very sensitive about this issue, but also later, after I wrote this poem, thinking about where I could put it in the collection. As I was arranging all the poems, and I love this poem, but where does it fit? And I'm happy with where I put it. Yeah, that poem was, it gave me challenges in many ways.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Yeah, when you're setting the intention of, like, how you want the reader to sort of experience them in order. It's a tough call sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely ordered the poem in a way that I thought made sense for the arc of the book. But hopefully, you know, if people skip around, because some people do read, you know, poetry collections in that way, I hope it still...
Oh, yeah, I read it sort of... non-linearly, and it still made sense to me.
Thank you.
The second time I read it, like, in order, when I had to upload the pages on Slack to Sarah, when I first bought, you know, had it in my hands, I definitely would just sort of, like, flip open somewhere and then read it, and it still felt very fitting that way too.
Really hard.
I'm sorry.
Ordering poems is really hard.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Trying to think about that for my own stuff, too, and it's so hard. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's like writing enough poems for a collection is hard enough, and then you have to think about putting them all in different...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then think about arc and whatever. So if you don't mind me asking, which of the Ordinary Misfortunes was the sort of, like, chronologically first one that came to you?
Yeah, the first one I wrote in the series, I believe, is the one about my grandmother during the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the one in which her father puts her in a crate and puts the crate into a shed. Yeah, I don't. That was the first one, and well, actually, I wrote it simultaneously. I think with the first poem of the book, you know, about actual comfort women, and that is mixed in with, like, that is framed within a contemporary conversation among me, an American man, and a Canadian woman.
Yeah, that one I felt really introduced it. The rest of the collection. So. If you were thinking about other ones, that was a good choice. The line, why don't you guys just get along, really
right,
stood out to me,
yeah,
as far as the ways that sort of people dismiss kind of generational things to be like, oh, why can't you just get over it?
Right. Yeah, I think I wrote that poem alongside the poem about my grandmother that starts with what is pressing. Yeah, even though my grandmother was not a comfort woman, I think that poem just came to me because I was thinking about other, you know, misfortunes that befall women's lives.
Right. Do you mind reading either one of those?
Sure, yeah. I'll read the first one. Mine is the jam-packed train.
Great.
An ordinary misfortune. Mine is the jam-packed train. The two-week cocktail, the statement by an American man at the bar, your life in Korea would have been a whole lot different without the U.S., meaning be thankful. This question by a Canadian girl, a friend, why don't you guys just get along? The guys, Japan and Korea, meaning move on. How do I answer that? Move on, girls on the train, destination, comfort station, things a soldier can do, mount you before another soldier is done. Say, drink the soup made of human blood. Say, the Korean race should be erased from this earth. Top down, bottoms up. Things erased, your name, your child, your history, your new name. Kumiko, Hanako, Yotiko. Name of the condom, charge number one. Name of the needle, compound 606. Salvation means an arsenic to save. Ratio 29-1, 29 soldiers per girl. Actual count, lost all. Shot, everybody. Give thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for asking me to read it. It's always a hard poem to read.
Yeah. I was really fascinated with there's already so many kind of, like, I can see why there's a lot of poems made about trains, because there's such an in-between kind of space. You're not in one, you know, like, destination or another. You're kind of in transit. And so I found that, like, very, very appropriate for this.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of comfort women were put in cargo trains, and they were, you know, treated as things, as objects, as goods for the Japanese soldiers. Mm. So I thinking of train as this space in which they were, I guess, it materialized into those objects, and of course a place where they realized, you know, they're finally very far away from home and being taken somewhere. It's like where that trauma was really concrete. It is really fascinating and very sad.
Yeah. And when you consider, like, kind of freight trains or cattle trains have been used to sort of, you know, transport people to concentration camps in Europe and the U.S., it's just like a very kind of dehumanizing
right.
space too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, really quick, like, I wasn't sure if that was sort of intentional, but some of the some of the, I feel like there was a lot of contemporary language in there. The shot, shot, shot. It was like a party song or something.
Right.
Or tops down, bottoms up. And it was such a contrast to the other stuff. It was just like devastating for me. I loved it.
Yeah, thank you. That was intentional. Thanks for noticing that.
I wanted to ask a little bit on page 41.
My grandmother.
Oh, sorry, 42. The other ordinary misfortune one.
Oh.
Where like the speaker is, it's like one of the few male speakers in there. And where he's like, I am not a man. And there's a lot there that I feel brings it out to the sort of like general problems of toxic masculinity and patriarchy there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I did want to write a poem that spoke to how toxic masculinity affects men as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I also did want to add another dimension to the history of the comfort women and say, you know, it's not like not all men who participated in this were like reveling in it, right? And they had to participate because of the pressure from other men and this situation that is the war. Although I of course didn't think, you know, this collection isn't about, you know, giving humanity to fire. Although I thought that, you know, I didn't want the collection to come off as like this from, I didn't want it to come off as if I'm coming from a nationalistic stance. It would villainize this whole country, this whole culture, and then, you know, put Korea on a pedestal as this very pure, innocent victim, this helpless, you know, sad victim, which is why I think it was important for me to write that poem and also important for me to include the section in the testimonies in which one of the comfort women says, you know, the man who basically tricked her into become a comfort woman, was he Korean or Japanese?
Right, and there was also a part I noticed that said, you'd think a former comfort woman would hate the Japanese. I don't. I hate men and I hate sex. I'm not sure if that's from the same one or not, but that really struck me too.
Right, yeah. I absolutely don't think, you know, I need to play the devil's advocate because the devil doesn't need an advocate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
I did want it to be complicated a little bit more. Like, wanted to go farther from saying, you know, this thing happened and we are just like, this is just tragic. You know, I wanted it to be more complicated from that, because
a little bit more nuanced
this history, right? Add nuance, because I think people who don't know this history, sometimes they would say things like, oh, like, Japan was evil, they don't mean to be patronizing, but I feel like I don't feel great when people say that to me.
No, yeah,
you know what I mean? It's not as simple as, it's not as black and white as good and bad and love. And that's not what I want to advocate. So.
Oh, definitely. I didn't read, you know, that into it. I feel like it was there, but it definitely didn't take away from the focus of the collection.
I'm glad, yeah. I wrote one poem and I was okay, that's enough. Speaking for them anymore. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a different title for the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was Charge Number One, which is the name of the condom.
Yeah, yeah.
The Empire gave its soldiers, and my agent, Jen, told me that we should change it. Yeah, so I was just combing through all the poems, thinking where I could, you know, pull the title from, because I am not good at coming up with titles.
That's tough, though.
Me neither.
It's,
yeah.
I can't come up with something just completely new and original. But, you know, maybe I already wrote it, like I hid it somewhere in a poem.
Yeah, it was kind of like calling out, because like the fact that it was repeated so many times, it gave it a lot of weight and almost sort of like the regularity, kind of like how you bring in Vivaldi's Four Seasons in the, you know, beginning poem or the second poem in the book.
Yeah, thank you. I thought it does fit for the whole collection because it's specific but general enough that it doesn't say it's just, this book is about one thing, but there are various cruelties.
I noticed too, you were then able to connect, you know, the history of comfort women with violence against other communities as well. I think you mentioned refugees, police brutality.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, what Korean men are still doing to the women of the Philippines, Southeast Asia in general, and just all these things. That's all the things that we do to one another as humans. And also to the natural world, right?
To go back to the one of the ordinary misfortune poems, could you read the one about on page 6 that was that the first one then that you wrote about your grandmother?
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll read that one. An ordinary misfortune. What is pressing? What is pressed? Or who? My grandmother, a woman, a teen. Her father presses the gate shut, presses her into a crate, the crate into a shed. She unfolds by morning, finds her chest. She walks on woman. An American soldier sees her and yells, "Stop over there," in Japanese, the language they both learned. When she runs, she's unmistakably woman. She falls. He laughs. What is a body in a stolen country? Or whose? What is right in war? What is left in war? War hasn't left Korea. I have. I fold. I give up myself to you. Which one of you said, "Let's have raunchy Korean sex," to me? Which one of you didn't? You represent America to me, but those soldiers to her. We didn't fear war. We feared the Allies, she said.
Thank you.
Oh, man. Yeah, that was good. Yeah. Thanks.
One thing that Jake and I talked about was sort of the theme of the trauma of diaspora, particularly
the diaspora.
Yeah, like in the line, you know, war hasn't left Korea. I have. Mm-hmm. I fold. I give up myself to you.
Yeah. I was thinking about that as I was writing this poem and actually all the other poems. What is my position in writing these poems here? You know, in the U.S. and in English,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's always a point of tension for me, and the question that I do get a lot. Well, you know, what is behind your choice to write in English rather than Korean? And I guess, you know, I always say it wasn't really a choice, because when I started writing a lot of poems, which was in high school, I was already living in Canada, living in an Anglophone country. And, you know, a lot of the poems I brought to my writing class, so they had to be in English. So it wasn't like deciding between the two languages. Like, there was really no decision. There was no option. But, you know, it happened so that I became more familiar with, like, the poetic rhythm in English. And I learned my own writing habits, my own poetry writing habits in English. So I just continued to write in English. And I continue to live in, you know, the U.S. So, yeah, that's how it really happened. But I do think about all this. What is my role in writing these so far away? But I realize, you know, what does it mean to be so far away? I'm geographically far away from Korea, the Korean Peninsula, but, you know, that I brought the history with me, So wherever I go, that history will be with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to stop being relevant to me because I'm somewhere else.
Right.
And because I am geographically far from Korea, I feel like I have more of a responsibility to talk about these things. Because it's not very much like the Korean War and the Comfort Women, all these histories, like they're not in the collective consciousness really in like anywhere else. I think, you know, I tell my grandmother I write like poems about her and that I use her stories. Like sometimes I record her. And she's happy. You know, she's happy that her stories are kind of living again in another language. For people who may not have prior knowledge about her stories. And I think, you know, telling her story is really important, not just because, you know, because she's my family, but also because I think a lot of people don't know about, you know, women's history during war, during the Korean War, and the lives of people who were not in or around Seoul, really. Because I think when a lot of people learn about the Korean War, they, of course, as it is with other war narratives, they learn about, you know, the front lines and battles, right? And
right, you find the people who actually live there are kind of bit part characters in their own story.
Yeah, and you know, where my family is from, the area that my family is from, Busan and the other cities around it, is like a place where everyone kind of fled to during the Korean War. It's like the place that wasn't, you know, taken over by war in the same way it wasn't in the front lines, because it's in the southernmost tip. You know, my grandmother wasn't around really, you know, the same, you know, same battle traumas. But her daily fear was whether she's going to get raped by an American soldier. Yeah, so I just think that her story is really important, filling in the gaps about what we don't know about the Korean War.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Everything, but yeah.
Let's see what else. Sorry. Yeah, I feel like it would be disingenuous of us to, you know, interview about, you know, your book and the main sort of issue that you're troubling is the erasure and the silence of the Comfort Woman narratives, and not ask if you'd want to read one of those. So out of the sort of testimony poems, is there one in particular that...
Well, they all feel very dear to me, but since I mentioned a section earlier, the Kim Sang-hee section about like whether not knowing whether the man was Japanese or Korean. Maybe I'll read that one. Testimony. Kim Sang-hee. I was 14 years old. It was around November 26th. It snowed, I remember. I was on my way home from the photo studio with my portrait when a man in olive wrap clothing grabbed me by the collar, cursed in Japanese. Was he Japanese or Korean? I could not tell. I was thrown onto a truck of mournful sounds of weeping. These girls and I crossed the border into China. There was no poison, no rope. In Suzhou, I was number 4. I was Takeda Sanai. The first night an officer grabbed me, I drank disinfectant, but I didn't die. In Nanjing, I had malaria, appendicitis, hemorrhage in my vagina, but I didn't die. In Singapore, I saw dark-skinned men digging ditches. They looked at us as if they would burst into tears. In Singapore, the war ended. We boiled leaves from trees and wild greens. We ate this to survive. When I made it back to Busan Harbor, I went to my brother's house in Daegu. In his dream, I had shaved my head, was drowning in the ocean.
but I didn't die. My name is Kim Sang-mi. I was born on December 20th, 1920. I was born into a good family. I am a Catholic. I should forget and forgive, but I cannot. When my head turns toward Japan, I curse her. I want to find solace, but I cannot. When I wake up every morning, I cannot.
Oof, man, that it ends on such a sort of bleak note. Mm-hmm. And I was very, I'm glad they don't all end on like that, because I'd be a lot less hopeful, but that's necessary too.
To just sit with that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
I imagine, it must have been so difficult to write in those voices, but how did the testimonies come about, if it's okay for me to ask?
The poems?
Yeah.
Come about.
Yeah, there was a primary source you worked from, right, that had the narratives written down?
Yeah, I was reading, history books with the transcriptions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wanted to just retell their stories. I think the original testimonies are the most important, but I was wondering, what can I do as a poet to reamplify these stories? How to be a mouthpiece for them yet again. So I pulled words from them and basically, rearranged them on the page.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Is that why they're sort of like broken up into
fragments?
Yeah.
So, I didn't change the stories, of course. Yeah, I guess they were kind of reborn in a poem form, mm-hmm. or medium. But it was really emotionally difficult for me to do it, not only because the stories are so harrowing, but also because I have to wonder, am I doing some kind of violence?
Right.
Yeah, are you retelling the stories in the right way? And
yeah, just putting them into poems, like, is this the right thing for me to do? Like, do I have the right to even tell these stories? I think I struggle with it to this day.
I wonder if about that a lot too.
Yeah, I wonder about it all the time, but I gave myself permission because, I did think, I'm not a historian,
right.
And at the time of this writing, I didn't have the resources or the knowledge into how to, write their stories. Like, I didn't know how I could maybe even approach people in the support organizations. I did email them, but they didn't respond. I just didn't really know how else I could
mm-hmm.
do my job as a poet in telling their story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I gave myself permission because, this is what I can do. This is what I can do to educate people who don't know about this history. And I have to think later. I'm not, changing their narrative,
mm-hmm.
but mm-hmm. rather just putting it in different form.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I have to be like, but who am I to tell these stories? I guess at a point, I have to think, I am a Korean woman who has always known about this, and this history is so close to everyone in Korea, and I think I could tell these stories as long as they come from empathy.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I have that question, like, who's benefiting from this? Right.
Right.
And I am making a donation to the Comfort Women Support Organization. And actually, I'm going to do, a social media giveaway thing.
Oh, cool.
I haven't posted it yet because I just received my box of books, but I'm giving away copies to people who bought my book, and just kind of paying forward.
Yeah, I think that's all we can do.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
My feelings are still very complicated, as you can tell. But
yeah.
I mean, for me reading it, I thought it was a very sensitive and humanizing portrayal of these women. But, I mean, have you had any responses specifically to it?
The responses that I've gotten have been all positive. Although, you know, there have been questions, like kind questions about what you think about, you know, the ethics of writing.
Right.
And, you know, I appreciate them because I think I always need to feel uncomfortable and tense about having written these and having put them out in the world. And every time I get that question, I think more about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it just gives me a chance to develop my stance.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, to relay that nuance, and I think of that whole kerfuffle with the white artist at the Whitney Biennial who did the Emmett Till painting, right? And you know, like, are you reproducing the trauma, or are you trying to sort of like face towards the community? And I felt yours created the sort of like was I don't know how to say it, just facing, you know, kind of in the proper way with, you know, as good as intentions as you could.
Yeah, and open, as you were saying before, open the door for the rest of the folks. But, yeah,
thank you for reading it that way. I'm really glad that they came off as sensitive and empathetic.
So I was wondering if you could read the last poem on, or the one on 52?
An Ordinary Misfortune. News reports that in the Philippines, more Koreans than locals are killed. Because of the gangs, because Filipinos think Koreans are rich, because Filipinos' laborers return from Korea with a bad taste in their mouths. More Korean deaths in the police for the safety of our people. In other news, Korea leads in tourists, businessmen, students looking for a guiltless fuck, guiltless departure, saying, these Filipinas, these children can't find me. Nothing but a bad taste in their mouths. Nothing but an empty desk. In other news, two boys file a suit against their Korean father. Say, were you not in the Philippines with us for 7 years? Say, won't you take a DNA test? Do the same men read about comfort women and rage with all of us, keep Bibles in their desks and preach, violence begets violence. Curse aloud, damn Filipinos taking Korean lives. The boys win the suit. Their father says, this will break up my family.
Yeah, thank you. I was wondering what your process was in kind of researching or writing that poem.
That poem came about because, like you said, this issue is much more contemporary, and, you know, there are documentaries and have been TV programs about Filipinos, right, Korean Filipino children, or rather, like, children in the Philippines who were born out of a Korean father, specifically. And, I mean, this issue is, I think, so important, but maybe a lot of Koreans don't know as much about. Maybe it is very urgent too, but it doesn't seem to be receiving a lot of the media attention that I think it deserves. And I thought that issue is so important because it feels like Koreans have forgotten about the violence that we have committed to other nations after the Korean War, like during the Vietnam War, for example. Yeah, I mean, it's just something that we don't know or recognize, I think, because for one, a lot of people don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But just the ruthlessness of the Korean soldiers during the Vietnam War is astounding, right? And you know, there are a lot of economic and social factors that went into it, you know, with our relations with the United States
after Japanese colonialism and all that, it is very complex, but it's something that I think we need to talk about and be aware of a lot more. And I really want to push against this kind of nationalistic attempt to just focus on all the things that Korea has endured as victims in history.
Right.
We also need to recognize what we have done to other countries.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, really violence begets violence. Yeah, and the willful ignorance and the undercurrent of racism underneath it, mm-hmm. really enraging.
And it's so complicated.
Yeah.
There's just no easy answer.
Toxic masculinity is a problem everywhere, right? And I'm just very disappointed whenever I just feel like Korean men don't know about what our men are doing in Southeast Asia, especially the Philippines with the sex industry. So, yeah.
So, now that, it took, years, a project of years to complete and, it's out in the world. Has there been any sort of any reactions to your book that kind of like give you hope that are, are very, very validating for you lately?
I have gotten a lot of, great positive feedback and reviews from friends and reviewers alike. And it's been a really uplifting experience for me that people approach this book with an open mind, even if they hadn't known much about the comfort women or Korean history. But one really beautiful thing that happened was, do you know Monica Sook?
Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan of her work.
She's an amazing poet, an amazing person. We were in the same cohort at NYU.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she's someone who I hold very dear to me because I told her in December when we were reading together in San Francisco that she makes me possible.
Oh.
The poems that she was writing about, the Khmer Rouge and her ancestors' history, and, really writing with her and writing alongside her in New York gave me a lot of courage to write my poems. And when we were reading with her, she also said, you make me possible through your seeing. And when I see you moving through the world, I feel like I can do that too. And it was just a really beautiful endowment for me that we have this positive influence on each other, that our poems influence each other's poems. And, there is just someone out there who I admire so much who, also looks to me as a comrade in this process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just really inspiring and beautiful. So,
That is inspiring. Yeah. Is there any other artist, poet, whatever friends that whose work you want to signal boost and recommend us to check out?
Yeah, I have so many poets. Oh gosh, every time I get asked this question, I blank out as if like I know nothing. But recently I've really loved Chen Chen's collection. When I Grow Up, I Want to Be a List of Further Possibilities.
Oh, okay.
Great title, right?
Yeah.
I really love E.J. Coe's book, A Lesser Love.
Oh, yeah. I keep meaning to go up to Seattle for one of her readings, but...
Yeah, I really love that book, and I want to see like more people talking about it and reading from it. I really love Kristen Chang's work.
Oh, I'm not familiar with her. I'll definitely look it up.
Her chapbook, I believe, just came out from Black Lawrence Press. It's Past Lives, Future Bodies, I think. Mm. Yeah, she is so wildly talented. You should really look her up. She has a lot of poems online too, published poems.
Okay.
Yeah, and her novel, I think, is coming out too in a few years. So
awesome.
So definitely keep her on your radar. And my friend Michael Pryor, another Asian Canadian poet, gifted me Phoebe Wang's book. I think she's also Asian Canadian, and he gave it to me because I said I don't know much about Canadian poetry, despite being Canadian.
Right.
And he gave me this book. Where did I put it? Admission Requirements, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I'm really looking forward to reading her book and reading more Canadian poetry in general. One more thing, of course. Sally Lunau's Oculus.
Oh, yeah. I liked her first book. I haven't seen the new one yet. She's so good.
It came out a couple days ago, and she's someone I deeply love and adore. So definitely read her book. She is incredible.
Yeah, thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate you taking your time.
Thank you for reading my book.
Mm-hmm.
Hope you have a good rest of the day. And
yeah, you too. Have a good fun day.
Yeah, thanks again, Emily. All right, take care. Bye.
And finally, the Pacific Underground Collective would like to publicly show our support for those in our KBOO community who are in want and in demand of needed systemic change here in our own community radio station. While there are individual volunteers and staff who have shown support in addressing these issues, we feel there is a pressing need for the KBOO community as a whole to express their views regarding the radical space that we call our radio home. So in solidarity, we will have 1 minute of dead air.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, January 25th, 2018. Donald Trump is again threatening to declare a national emergency to force the funding of his border wall. He says he has drafted the emergency order that would authorize troops and federal resources to construct a barrier between the U.S. and Mexico, a barrier that virtually every security expert agrees is ill-conceived and ineffective. The wall would also violate tribal sovereignty on reservations along the border and is opposed by local governments of most U.S. border towns. This announcement by Trump comes after the Senate failed yesterday to advance a pair of competing proposals to reopen the government and end the partial shutdown, which is now in its 35th day. The first vote was on a Republican-backed proposal to allocate $5.7 billion for Trump's border wall. The second vote was on a Democratic-backed proposal to temporarily reopen the shuttered government agencies without providing any money for a wall. Both measures fell short of the 60 votes needed to advance. The two votes were the first the Senate has taken to reopen the government since the shutdown began on December 22nd. Meanwhile, another advisor to Donald Trump has been arrested by the FBI. Roger Stone has been charged with 7 counts, including making false statements and witness tampering. In arresting Roger Stone, the special counsel, Robert Mueller, revealed the most direct link yet between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks in their release of files stolen from the Democratic Party headquarters by Russia to damage the election campaign of Hillary Clinton. The special counsel disclosed evidence today that in 2016, a top official from the Trump campaign sent Roger Stone, a longtime advisor to Donald Trump, to get information from WikiLeaks about the thousands of hacked Democratic emails. The effort began after evidence had already emerged that Russian intelligence operatives were behind the theft. Stone was released today after posting $250,000 bail. In Oregon news, the Eugene police officer who shot and killed a dad taking their child out of school on January 11th will not be charged. The district attorney's office ruled that the killing was justified. Charlie Landeros was a community activist in Eugene with a 12-year-old daughter who was a student at the school. Landeros was asked to leave by school security, who then called the police on the distraught parent. In the parking lot of the school, police decided that even though Landeros was leaving the school grounds as requested, they would arrest Landeros for disorderly conduct. When the police grabbed Landeros, they apparently pulled out a gun, at which point they were shot and killed. In other local news, a week after white supremacists with the Vancouver-based Patriot Prayer assaulted members of the IWW union in Portland, the union headquarters has been vandalized with spray paint. Unknown assailants wrote "Smash Communism" and "Antifa House" on the IWW headquarters in southeast Portland. They also spray painted the bar Cider Riot, which is known for its support for anti-fascists in Portland. The IWW, which stands for the Industrial Workers of the World, asked for donations of white paint to cover the graffiti. They stated that all unions should be concerned about this attack on the working class, saying an injury to one is an injury to all. That's it for the KBOO News at